Hi, coming up on Twit, we have the week in security conferences, the banning by Twitter of Kaspersky, and a look at why iPhone is making quite so much money out of its latest handset. This is Ian Thompson at the Register, standing in for Leo Laporte, and this is another Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit, episode 663, recorded on April 22nd, 2018. Reasonably miserable.
This Week in Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. And by ZipRecruiter. Hiring? ZipRecruiter has revolutionized how you do it. Their technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. ZipRecruiter finds great candidates for you. Try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. Sign up today at Betterment.com/twit and get up to 1 year managed free. And by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. And now, the second-generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Eero, Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter the code TWIT.
Hi, and welcome to another Twit. I'm Ian Thompson from The Register, standing in for Leo Laporte, who is currently investigating the Far East and no doubt playing Mario Kart in Tokyo and having an awful lot of good ramen. With me is, as regular Twit regulars will be familiar, Michael, who is, you know, in this country for a few
years. I'm in this country, can you believe it?
You are the traveling technology
I'm
reporter
also in
and
this county. I'm here in person, yeah. So, yeah, I'm glad you clarified that you are Ian and not Leo, because I thought, you know, Leo has done something with his hair.
He's got this weird accent.
He always does these weird accents, and I thought, wow, this is really good.
I tried to get in there with a shirt, though. So,
yeah, okay. It helps.
But, yeah, also providing some snark from our Australian friends, although based in Britain, we have Greg.
Hello.
Greg is, as you may want to, at the Thrill Mind podcast. You're up fairly late, it seems. So, we're looking forward to this. How's it going?
It's all going well. It's been another inspirationally cynical week in technology, of course. As always, big companies are really doing dumb things, just as you'd expect them to do. So I'm looking forward to running down the list tonight and giving you some insights from the other side of where I live.
Okay. And then last but definitely no means least, considering you've been – I was thinking about it. We've actually got probably a century of technology experience just in the four of us here.
You don't have to get nasty.
No, we should be proud of it. I got my RSA badge and it had 20-year veteran on it. It was like, okay, I'm an old fart, but still. But Dwight's joining from Houston, and you've been doing this now. So you're online in 2000, so I mean, way ahead of most of the field. How's it going down there?
Oh yeah, good. Actually, I've been doing this since like 1990, so it's been forever. It's great here in Houston. We got a beautiful day, almost California-like weather, and I hope it lasts.
Oh, yes, although Houston and humidity tend to go together like eggs and bacon, but yes, we shall see. Right, well, it's been a very, very busy week. We've had not one but three security conferences in San Francisco. Starts off with B-Sides on Sunday, then we had the main RSA 40,000 people jamboree kicking off in the main town, but also the RSA conference, which was set up after RSA managed just to get one female keynote speaker, and a bunch of people in the industry said, hang on a second, we do have more women than that in InfoSec. And then RSA gave out the solution, which was, well, there's only very few women in InfoSec, so it's not something worth worrying about. And in a couple of days, they'd managed to sort out 14 female speakers and one token male. Did you get down to RSA?
I signed up and then didn't go because I just didn't have the time. But I've gone before. I miss miss the old days, because then you could just use the women's bathroom and there was no line. It was fantastic if you had the guts to do that. But I guess, things change and now you have to wait in line.
It was a total sausage fest. It was a good, went down to the Enigma conference earlier this year, and they said one of the really encouraging signs is that there's a line for the ladies as well for the gents.
It's so, progress. It's progress.
Yeah, we're getting there. I mean, it's, was there anything that really sort of grabbed your attention from this? I mean, RSA is always very tricky because they sell a lot of their keynotes off when not a lot gets said, but I don't know, there's some interesting stuff.
There was a lot of interesting stuff going on. I think that one of the most interesting things in the sort of culture of security technology in general is that the threats and the problems and the exploits and the all that stuff is so, they're so common, they're so large, they're so frequent that there's at any given time now there's like 15 major things for people to stress out and worry about. And you know, you really almost have to go to a conference like this to have the slightest inkling of exactly what the threats are, what the threats aren't. And it's just keeps getting worse. And so, I think it's getting to the point where platforms like the Chromebook, it's getting to the point where people are just going to have to do pretty serious, if they want to have any security at all, pretty serious, extreme measures just to have basic security because, you know, it's an arms race. And I feel like people who want security are losing that arms race.
I think very much so. I mean, it's a question of, I mean, defense is always much harder than offense. But, I mean, in terms of stuff that we've got coming through the line, Dwight, Greg, anything that really grabbed your attention?
No, the RSA conference is generally a waste of time. I have a completely different opposite view to Mike Elgin.
You know, there's a couple of RSA marketers putting your name on a dartboard right now.
I don't go to any of the mega conferences because it's basically so much noise and effectively zero signal. The challenge with the RSA conference is it only happens once a year. And the thing about security is we're actually, in my view, is you're actually patching what is fundamentally broken products. So how much effort do we expend trying to make Windows safe and fit for use? How much effort do you spend making Android bug-free or, you know, trying to get your patches on or all that sort of stuff? The simple fact is the whole security industry exists because IT vendors are so bad at making products and then they've doubled down on convincing us to fix their products by going into an aftermarket to fix the faults that shouldn't have been in there in the first place.
See, Greg, the reason you think that they're a waste of time is because you're not going on a press pass. If you're in the press, it's a convenient way to meet all kinds of people, plus free alcohol. So
I've done the conferences on the press pass, and same thing holds true. Mm. You still don't meet anybody that's useful or worthwhile. You meet executives who make one or two decisions a year and think that they're really impressive and important. But the real work is actually done amongst the hackers, and they don't go to RSA except to go and hang out in bars and to practice karate moves on each other and stroke each other's ponytails
and don't forget the suspenders. So lest anybody be confused, that there's actually the quality of the people you can meet is in the middle. So the big conferences like CES, you can't meet anybody. Like, you know, it's Mobile World Congress is difficult as well, although there are some smaller European vendors you can reach. The very smallest conference, nobody's there either. The middle-sized conferences, which I actually think conferences like RSA is in the ballpark, you actually get some really interesting, you get technologists who are leading some of the sessions. You can buttonhole them after their sessions and learn some things. As an opinion columnist, it's a great way to like sort of get a spark of an idea where you're like, it's not the information, it's the guy with the ponytail stroking thereof and so on.
That wasn't RSA this time round. This was B-Sides.
Okay.
B-Sides was 2 days of hacking. Yeah. Not only do they have just, it's a 2-day run, they've got genuine hackers there. They also, to come back to your earlier point, give out drinks tickets with the conference passes. And Marcus Hutchins from the WannaCry thing was there this year. There's a lot of interesting research. I mean, Dwight, what's your view on big conferences? Are they worth the trouble or is it just like marketing fluff?
I think it depends kind of on who you are. You know, if you are somebody that they want to talk to, you know, if you're from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, you're somebody that has a big megaphone and a large audience, you'll find the people who want to talk to you and you can buttonhole them. you know, I have worked for a long time for a mid-level paper that sometimes gets some attention and sometimes gets some love from these folks. And so I think they can be, if you know who to talk to and you have something very specific. As far as security conferences go, I kind of like DEF CON and Black Hat. Those are the ones. I mean, if you can survive it as a member of the media, because they'll harass the hell out of you. But I think DEF CON and Black Hat are probably the better choices for if you really want to talk to people and find out what's going on.
Then you have to go to Vegas, and nobody wants that.
Well, I have to
that's
do
right.
It,
well, that's the
yeah. I have to do it every year, and it's the one thing that will get me into Vegas in August, besides a cattle prod. But I would disagree on Black Hat, because that now is basically RSA with hookers. Whereas DEF CON has got very big. There are like 20,000 people there last year, so it's kind of getting too big to be functional. But again, B-Sides in Las Vegas, going on just before the main shows kick off, I went there for the first time last year. Pretty damn good. But yeah, I mean, Black Hat...
Once a conference gets beyond 5,000 people, it just doesn't... there's just too much... just physically getting around is very difficult. Finding signal in the noise, finding the people that you want to talk to, it stops being a happy day. But particularly security conferences, most of the time what you're seeing is grandstanding or stunt hacking. The security companies are saving up their best product announcements for that week. And you end up with all this news crammed into a week. And then you can't cover it because, the news cycle is such that when we cover those conferences in the shows that I publish, you really have to pick out no more than three or four things. But so much is announced in a single week. And really, these vendors would be better off just going into the release cycle and looking for the quiet periods and announcing their products or their transitions when, not at a football game, but when there's a quiet time and places for us to cover it.
Yeah, and it helps to go in with a focus. I mean, if you just go in and wander around and, talk to people, you'll get something. But if you do your homework, look for stuff in advance, figure out exactly what you want to know and who might be able to talk to you about it, things will come out a lot better.
Well, this is it. Once the speakers list is announced, then every journalist is just like, right, okay, let's go through the speakers list, see if they're willing to talk to us early. That way I can save myself trogging around Caesars trying to get to the right place. But, I don't know, in many ways the conference season seems to have got a little bit too large in some areas. But then again, we have, we have CES over here, but we've got Mobile World Congress in Spain. You've got CeBIT in Hanover if you're really a masochist. So
two of the things that's interesting in technology in the Bay Area is that there are so many conferences. And the other one is there's so much experimentation in terms of startups. So half the startups that have some experimental thing will roll out in one city. That city will be San Francisco. Every once in a while, it's Bay Area, like Pizza Robots started in Mountain View. The whole thing about, a concierge would come and park your car. That was in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. People come and take out your trash. That was San Francisco. And so it's the Bay Area is an interesting place for conferences. And the reason for that, I don't think it's the attendees. I think it's the speakers and so on. So if you have a conference on artificial intelligence and you have it in the Bay Area, there's some really good speakers there, and you have Google people showing up and all this kind of stuff. And so it's a really nice place. New York City is pretty good too. But generally speaking, conferences are a whole different plot. But the downside is half the conferences that you see on a calendar of tech conferences are complete garbage. They're for wannabes who just, and you go to these things and it's just wannabes talking to wannabes. Nobody's really doing anything interesting. Mm. And so you got to pick and choose, but there's some really good conferences in San Francisco. Again, around artificial intelligence, some of the sort of leading edge, interface conferences, very, very specific conferences that are actually pretty cool. And like Greg said, these are you're going to have like 1,000 people or 2,000 people at these things.
Mm. It's really easy. Like you said, it's easy to get speakers in San Francisco, and a lot of easy to get speakers who don't want to get paid in San Francisco, which is a big deal to making conferences profitable. So.
Or indeed selling off the keynotes themselves, which is another way to make them insanely profitable. But,
yes, that's right. Yeah.
But one of those things. Okay, well, we'll return to Security Matters a little later on. But right now, Leo may be far away, but he does have this message from our sponsors.
Thank you, Ian. Let me interrupt just for a moment. I know I'm in Japan, but I had to come back and tell you about LastPass. I am such a believer. It's really nice when we can get an advertiser that I've been using forever. Actually, a lot of our advertisers are that way. Certainly LastPass. You've heard me talk about LastPass. We like LastPass so much. Steve Gibson interviewed the creator, Joe Segrist. Boy, that's a few years ago now. Joe was, you know, very kind to Steve, showed him everything, how it works, all the code. And Steve gave it his absolute seal of approval. He uses LastPass. If you have to keep track, and it's not just passwords, although that's the big thing, but of passwords, but I also use it for driver's license, social security numbers, private stuff of all kinds, where I know it's safe, and it's both safe, locked up, but also accessible wherever I am. Desktop, laptop, smartphone, tablet, my LastPass goes with me everywhere. And that means I can log into any site anytime. Patrick Delahanty, our programmer guy here, who's also a LastPass user, says he likes it because he forget, you know, he'll create an account for a site like DMV once every 3 years, right? You got to make a Department of Motor Vehicles log in to make an appointment. You don't remember that. You may not even remember you made the site, but when you go to the site, the LastPass little logo pops up and you fill it in. You go, oh yeah, I do have an account. I do that all the time. All the time. LastPass goes through all of your, if you want, they have a great security check, goes through all your passwords, tells you which ones need to be updated. It has one button automated update for many, many sites. It works so easily, Android and iOS, where it just fills it in automatically. So no typing means no more mistakes. I can go on and on. LastPass is the best way to keep track of all of your passwords and credentials and serial numbers and special documents. My, you know, when I travel, I put my passport in LastPass. It's secure there, but then I have a copy of my passport on everything. And that's the cool thing about LastPass. It synchronizes with everything. Now, the password vault, which is synchronizing, is completely secure, 256-bit AES encryption. Even LastPass can unlock it, which is nice. And I add, in addition to that, I add second-factor authentication. So it's got a good, long, strong password. I use two-factor authentication. I feel very, very confident that that password vault is safe, and yet it's everywhere. And when I set up a new computer, first thing I put on my computer, first thing I put on my new phone, LastPass, because it's going to help me log into everything else. We use LastPass at work. We have LastPass Enterprise. And one of the benefits we give all our employees is a LastPass account for free because I'm such a strong believer in this. It's the number one most important thing you can do to protect yourself online. LastPass products for enterprise, for premium, for personal use, for families. LastPass for teams. They've got a product that's right for you. Find out more. Fix your password woes. Protect yourself. Improve your security. And it's more convenient. LastPass.com/twit. You know, I always say there's a trade-off between security and convenience. In this case, you get both. You really do. LastPass.com/twit. If you're not yet a LastPass customer, what's holding you up? Pause the podcast and go do it. LastPass.com/twit. Are you all right? You done? Okay, now we can resume Ian Thompson and the Twit family. Go ahead, guys.
Right, okay, so it's been a headline-grabbing week for Apple. When has it not been? But we did have the report that when it comes to actual smartphone sales, Apple and the product line are taking over a third of the entire revenue straight out the bat. So all those mobile phone manufacturers out there, the billions of smartphones out there, Apple is sucking it up. Now, we have a mixed panel here. Some Apple users, some Android users. Mike, you've actually bought your wood-framed iPad here. You have.
Yes.
You haven't gone for the iPhone 10 or X, depending on how you describe it.
No.
10 or X, which one would
10.
You?
10. Yeah. Go with the 10, yep, because I think the next one's going to be an 11. They pulled a Microsoft. They skipped a generation. There has been no iPhone 9. But yeah, iPhone 10 for sure. iPhone
7, 8, 9, or, sorry.
One of the things I was surprised about, obviously, you know, Apple always dominates profits. If you think about what does Apple make, the one thing they make better than anyone is profits.
Mm-hmm.
But iPhone 10 actually had much significantly higher profits than any of the other iPhones. The numbers
it was so ridiculously priced? Or?
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, we're probably going to talk about the Samsung, the cost of the Samsung screen and so on, so it's expensive for them to make. And, it's amazing they got as many people to buy it as they did. But 35% of the industry's profits were the iPhone 10, 19% the iPhone 8, 15% the iPhone 8 Plus, 6% iPhone 7, 5% iPhone 7. The first non-Apple device on the list is the Galaxy Note 8 at 3.9%, basically 4% of the industry profit. So Apple, once again, is winning it all. And this doesn't even tell you what they're making on app sales. They get a third of all the app sales. Streaming services like Apple Music and so on. It goes on and on and on. They make money on everything, every aspect of the, just about every aspect of the phones. But this is just for selling the hardware. And it's really, it's the business story of, I think, the decade or the millennium or something like that. They just are printing money. And it's kind of ridiculous. They're on track to be the first $1 trillion valuation company.
I think Amazon might get there first. I'm not sure.
Could be. It could be.
A fight for it at the moment.
Yeah, not if President Trump has anything to do with it.
Well, we may come on to that later on. I mean, Greg and Dwight, what's your view on this? I mean, are you Apple fanboys? Are you Android users? Are you?
I am an Apple user. And I use pretty much all their products. It's not a surprise they are aiming at the high end of the market, where the profits naturally are better. They've made Apple an aspirational brand, so you want to have it, maybe even if you can't afford it. And they have a variety of products, you know, in a variety of price ranges. So I think they're being very smart about it. The question is how much can they sustain? You know, they have earnings coming up on May 1st, and there have been several analysts who have said, well, they're just not doing as well as expected on the iPhone X. And so we'll get a better look at what is actually going to happen when those earnings drop.
So I'm an Apple user or an Apple consumer. I'm not a fanboy. I was a fanboy, but increasingly I'm less inspired by Apple's going forward. I think the price is getting out of whack with the value being delivered. As it says here, 21% of the total revenue goes to Apple, but they make 35% of the total industry profits. I've heard different numbers. I heard they sort of take 30% of the total revenue, but 70% of the total profits or whatever. But either way, Apple's charging is working in the premium end of the market and charging premium pricing that it has a vast profit margin. But then not only that, but part of the reason they're making that profit margin is a couple of things. One is security. Unlike a Microsoft or an Android, your device is more or less secure, although there's signs that there's cracks in that coming forward. It's not buggy compared to anybody else's smartphones or anybody else's products. And so they do actually have a reason for being regarded as a premium supplier. But I think the other thing that we are not covering here that's not covered in this report, of course, is that Apple is very much increasing its ARPU, Avenue Revenue Per Customer, or Average Revenue Per User, to be literal, by having things like the headphones, you know, the Apple earphones they've got with the X1 chip inside, Apple TVs. The Mac is increasingly an accessory to the iPhone. The App Store, the music, the HomePod, you know, all those accessories mean that you're not just buying the phone anymore. The phone is the linchpin of an entire ecosystem around which you're going to buy, you know, one or more of those fries with the iPhone burger. And I think you don't underestimate that much that part of the strategy.
Greg, just to follow up on that and clarify, you said that your understanding was that the Apple was north of 70% total profits. That used to be the case, and now they're up to 87%. The 35% is the iPhone X alone. So the iPhone X by itself as one of the many profitable Apple devices makes more profit than the top 600 Android makers combined.
It's utterly bonkers. I mean, it's almost like with Android, bonkers. It's a race to the bottom, whereas Apple has just said, yeah, let's make this a premium thing. But then it isn't really reflected in their other product lines. And that, I mean, Greg, you said this is the linchpin, but I know a lot of MacBook users who are really, really annoyed at the moment that their laptops are not getting love. We're using outdated hardware. They've just said that the next MacBook isn't going to be coming through the line until 2019. I mean, has Apple given up on laptops?
I think there's a few things happening there. One is Intel's product line has been disrupted. They've missed a couple of generations in the CPUs. We always expected to see Intel release new CPUs. They did the tick-tock, and we expected them to happen every year. And then Intel shifted to a three-year strategy. And I just have the sense, and this is just pure speculation on my part, Apple was doing something and they missed a generation or two because whatever it was they were working on didn't work. So I know that, for example, Apple, Intel completely failed to deliver on mobile processors and mobile CPUs.
Twice.
And yeah, that's right. And so if you were betting, you know, you had a whole production line ready to go, and then Intel suddenly pulls the pin on that CPU that they were going to push out there, and you're Apple, because Apple had puts all of its weight behind a single product. There's not, like, you know, Samsung, they have like 9 to 10 product families. Apple has 2 smartphones in the market today, basically the X and the 8. They don't have this massive diversity which allows them to fail in one product line and fail over. They go all the way in. So if Intel pulled the product line too late, then Apple might not have had a backup strategy in place, and that's why we haven't seen the iteration. So I'm not entirely sure that putting the blame at Apple's feet is the thing to do. Of course it is, because it's up to them to meet the market and meet users' expectations and to manage user expectations. I think that's the thing that Apple's failed to do here. We have an expectation as Apple customers to see a refresh cycle on the Mac roughly every 2 years, a major trend, and we haven't seen that. And they haven't come out and talked about it or been public about it, and we really feel a bit abandoned. Like, I'm sitting here with a 2012 MacBook waiting patiently for the next one because I'm not leaving my ports behind. So yeah. I'm in that boat.
Well, and the other thing is that you can wait with a 2012 MacBook Pro because it still works, it's still fast, it still uses the most recent operating system. You know, one of the things I think Apple has kind of some runway to coast on, because its products do last forever. I'm working here with a 2015 MacBook Pro. I have no desire to go to anything else. I've got a 2012 Mac Mini at home, which has a Core i7, and I've put in 2 SSDs, and it's as fast as anything that I could get from Apple. I'm very happy with it. And so they have some grace there, I think, with their users that allow them, while they do have probably the pro side people, who the ones who want something new all the time, I think people who buy them and hold on to their machines for a long time can do that, and they have some goodwill.
I think sometimes, though, also you get to the point where a product category reaches, it becomes as good as it kind of can possibly be in a way. And laptop, and for a long time, Apple was leading the charge with little things like unibody aluminum construction and the Retina display and all that. They were able to stay ahead. Now it's to the point where everybody's kind of caught up. You can buy much lower cost laptops that have those kinds of features. A lot of them look just like, you know, they have the aluminum bodies. They look a lot like the MacBook Pros and stuff. Meanwhile, there's this gradual shift toward mobile, toward phones, and to a lesser extent tablets, but mostly phones, where more people are doing more stuff and spending more time on their phones, and so it's less important. I think the next big thing that Apple's going to do, and this is going to be a controversial point because everybody right now says, I'm going to hate this, which is going to be a solid-state laptop. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to have – I think within the next few years, Apple's going to come out with a laptop that runs iOS, that has it's going to be 2 screens, clamshell with 2 screens. The bottom screen, the keyboard will be an on-screen keyboard. There are all kinds of advantages. There are all kinds of disadvantages. And I've written pretty extensively about this. Guys like us hate the idea, but I think this is the future, because kids, I mean, if you look at people entering the workforce today, many of them never, ever use a physical keyboard. Even using a larger device larger than a phone is somewhat alien to the iGen, or whatever you want to call the upcoming generation.
But hasn't Tim Cook actually not explicitly, but he gave us a pretty strong hint this week that they didn't think that Mac OS and iOS should be merged.
That's right. They're not going to be merged. Well, I'm talking about iOS, pure iOS. They're going to continue to have the cars and trucks divergent. Steve Jobs, if you recall, said, well, some people need a truck, some people need a car. iOS is a car. I think Mac OS is going to be a truck. They will still have Mac OS laptops, and I think they're going to have iOS laptops. I think they're going to have real keyboard laptops, and I think they're going to have on-screen keyboard laptops. And by the way, these on-screen keyboard laptops are actually going to be kind of great, because the whole bottom of this clamshell will become whatever you want it to be. It can become like a tablet for drawing. It can become a DJ scratch pad. It can become anything that the app demands it to be. Meanwhile, if you do want to have a physical keyboard, if you write like we do, You just have a Bluetooth keyboard, and as I do with my iPad. So I don't think it's the end of the world for them. They got tons of patents, and I'm pretty sure the first of these devices is actually going to be a future case for the iPad. I think they're going to have an iPad where the bottom right now they have this sort of like physical
keyboard. So you're talking about a Chromebook style iPad that's got a keyboard and a screen but runs iOS.
But, well, it has a screen and another screen, and the bottom screen
keyboard
is a, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on the higher end devices, what we don't sort of think enough about is how amazing haptics will be, first of all. And in like 5, 6, 7, 8 years, these screens will actually have little bumps that rise and fall. When you tap the thing, you'll feel it drop. There'll be key travel on a all-screen laptop. And that's going to be pretty crazy technology that will change the whole sort of the whole reputation of on-screen keyboards, I think.
But there has been an Apple patent on that. I've seen, Patently Apple has done something with that. So that actually is obviously could be done. And I and Mike, take my money because I'll buy that.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
but I mean, I've seen how Google has tried to merge Chrome OS and Android, and it's buggy as all hell at the moment.
Well, I think that's why they're creating Fuchsia. For a long time, I was a Fuchsia denialist. Fuchsia, if you're not super familiar with Fuchsia, the Fuchsia OS is an operating system that Google has been working on from scratch, and you can find it on GitHub. And it basically, you can even look at it in a browser. I just wrote a piece about mobile operating systems on Computer World. If you want to check out the link to the browser, I guess that's the most efficient way to find it. Go to my Twitter feed, Mike Elgin. You can find it there. But basically, it looks like this is an operating system that could run on phones and on tablets. It could replace Android and Chrome. But I think that the model for it is going to be like, what does Google call it? The instant apps, where only the parts of the app that you need are downloaded. Yeah, you never install an app. Imagine an operating system where all the apps are like that. It'd be pretty cool.
I mean, Fuchsia is an attempt to fix the problems of Android, as I understand it. So the Android operating system has reached the practical limit of what it can do. And when they OEM'd it and open-sourced it, all the other companies out there who've been using the Android operating system to sell smartphones, most of them still working on a version of that code from 2011, I believe, or 2014, version 4, whatever that is. And they've got no motivation to upgrade those devices and move forward. So the purpose behind Fuchsia is to actually build an operating system which automatically patches, automatically updates, so that when OEM vendors take it, they won't be able to like ignore the requirement for security and patching, right? And then, as you say, the feature that Google wants, or that Google thinks can differentiate itself from its competitors, is to have the instant install. So instead of going to an app store and downloading the app and having it download a whole bunch of stuff, why not just download a stub, and then while you start playing with the app in the background, it's streaming down? That's something Google's been trying out for quite some time. I don't think that's going to be successful, not because it won't be technologically successful, but because there's not enough bandwidth in the world to make that happen. You have to be in places where, you know, 4G, 5G with massive fat pipes and content delivery network nodes close to the point where you can actually stream the app out to the phone. You're assuming there's enough bandwidth. And if you look at countries like Indonesia and, out there where the vast numbers of these low-cost phones go, that technology isn't going to work.
Well, you can also you can imagine a world where or an operating system where it kind of works like a Chromebook, where you know what you download it and it stays there, it's persistent, or it can download in the background. And again, I think that Google will always have sort of a light version of whatever its mobile operating system is. And we also don't know what the timeline is. Maybe Fuchsia comes online in 10 years or something like that, when we all have jetpacks and all that stuff. it's pretty slow going. They don't have a whole lot. They have a few important people working on Fuchsia, but not a lot of people. It's like 100 people or something like that, which for Google is like close enough.
Well, for an operating system, it's enough. Sorry, you don't need that many people to make our operating system. Really, a team of 100 top-notch computer scientists is all you need, as long as you don't have this infinite scope of works. I'm not too worried about the numbers. What I'm thinking about, like, there's research out there showing that 55% of people who own phones never install an app. And that's what this is. That's the need that they're identifying. It, you know, you need a certain amount of technical infrastructure, and I'm not convinced that that's possible. Sorry, Ian, I shouldn't have jumped
just
in.
To be Debbie Downer about this thing. So the instinct for those of us who think about technology a lot is, oh, Fuchsia is going to replace Android. It's going to solve Android's problems and replace Android, and it's going to replace the Chrome OS. Remember, this is Google we're talking mm-hmm. about. If the past is any guide, we're facing a world that will have Fuchsia and Android and Chrome right. OS, a big mess on our hands. This is kind of what Google does. They are a
cast
sort of
spread across the waters and see what comes up exactly. and whether or not it sinks.
Look at their messaging and communication apps.
Well, actually, we're going to be coming to that in just a little second. But first off, we have another message from Leo and from the people that keep Twit on the air. So over to you, Leo.
The Twit Show this week brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you are hiring, you're doing something, you're doing God's work. You're doing the most important part of the company. You're building it piece by piece. A company is really nothing more than a bunch of people with an aligned common goal. And the people who are at your company are what makes the company succeed or fail. That's why hiring is the most important job. And it's yours. If it is yours, you got to know about ZipRecruiter. It is the way to bring the right person into your enterprise and to make sure you never hire the wrong person too. Every business needs a better way to find great people. And ZipRecruiter is the one. Better than posting your job online and just hoping the right people see it. The great thing about ZipRecruiter is that you're posting it to 100 plus job boards the minute you click the button, right? So it's getting out to the most people. And then ZipRecruiter does something really cool. They build a platform that finds the right candidates for you. So get this, ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people in their giant database, millions of resumes, identifies people who have the right experience, then invites them to apply to your job. It's like you've got a headhunter working for you the minute you post. These invitations have revolutionized how people find their next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. You post today, tomorrow you'll have a quality candidate. If you're in a hurry, this is the best. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the best applications so you never miss a match. They say, you should look at this one. The right candidates are out there. You need them. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs right now. You can try ZipRecruiter absolutely free. Yeah, free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. We thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. Now back to the show.
Thanks, Leah. Okay, now we just mentioned Google's messaging, and there was a piece in a couple of titles. Google sort of hasn't said anything official on this point, but has leaked to some friendly media people who it knows just to, I think, float some trial balloons about once again trying it with messaging. Now, we've seen over the years Google try an awful lot of things with messaging, lots of different apps all over the place, then trying to merge them, then splitting them apart. Mike, Google, should they just stop trying to do messaging? It's not going to happen for them.
No, they should keep trying. And in fact, this latest move, which is being portrayed in the press as, oh, here's another thing in messaging from Google. This isn't another thing. This is the thing that Google's been working behind the scenes on for many, many years, and it's a very positive thing. And here's what essentially we're talking about. SMS has been with us forever. SMS stands for short message service. It's basically, long story short, it's something that already existed. It was a channel that already existed.
It was an engineering mobile function.
Yeah. Exactly. And they said, let's use this. It's free for the carriers, and yet we can charge for it. It's free money.
Well, only in the U.S. In Europe, you got it for free. Yeah. One of the things coming over here was just like, hang on, you're charging me for SMS? It's ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, so how are they actually building that into the new messaging client that you can
see? Well, basically what they're doing is Google's been working on this replacement for SMS, which is RCS. And RCS is problematic as a news. In the old days, you could build standards. There weren't a million multi-billion dollar corporations all trying to get advantage in new standards. And so you could just have a single standard. The internet was built on these single standards, that, and that's why it all works together, whereas nowadays it's very difficult. So Google's actually been doing the right thing for a change. They've been exercising their heft and leadership to get all the carriers to buy into RCS, to a single type and implementation of RCS that will make it interoperable. Because again, without somebody like Google, you can see moving from SMS to RCS and then going back to the days when you had to be on the same carrier, you know, multiple incompatible versions, and it's a big nightmare and it wouldn't work. And so RCS, just to be clear, is not something that will function like SMS. It's a feature, it's a technology that's built into the apps. So any app could support the Google implementation of RCS. You need a phone to support RCS. Mm. You need the carrier to support RCS. Right now, RCS exists, but nobody uses it because you need perfect alignment. Both parties need the phone, the app, and the carrier.
And it's still lacking in encryption. No end-to-end
exactly.
encryption.
This is not iMessage. And so iMessage or any number of other messaging apps have end-to-end encryption, but they have the flaw that not everybody supports it. So only iPhone users can use take advantage of it. You know, if I send, which I do commonly, if I send a message to somebody who uses Android, well, that is not encrypted. The pictures and videos are dumbed down and become low quality. There's all kinds of problems with it. So this is a best case scenario for a leader like Google to get everybody singing from the same hymn book for the future of the SMS replacement. It's in general a very good thing. Their history with apps is a very bad thing, but this is actually a very good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Doubtful, though. I think RCS is probably dead, is flogging a dead horse. The carriers don't want it. The people in the telco industry who monitor this sort of thing basically can't see. There's certain technical challenges around RCS. You're asking the telcos to go out and replace all of their base stations and to not only keep the SMS functionality but to layer RCS over the top. And there's no money attached to it. So for these telcos to go and implement RCS, where's the money that they're going to get from supporting this new service? And there is none, because SMSs are basically free. So why would they go out and deploy this RCS? Two, the technology behind RCS is actually pretty rubbish. People don't like it very much. There's not too many products out there that make it work. And then the final thing is that getting everything right. So it's one of these network effects. Once everybody's got RCS, then it becomes useful. And yes, it would be, I agree with you, Mike, that it would be a very good thing to replace SMS with the rich communication services, which starts, you know, allows SMS to look like it's something from 2010 instead of like 1999. But I don't, you know, and have a universal messaging platform that's not linked to somebody like Apple's iMessage or Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp or, you know, whatever it is. But I just don't see telcos globally coming together to implement RCS in their networks to replace SMS when there's no money attached to that service, where there's no value add, there's nothing that drives customers, and there's nothing that improves the customer experience, so that even then they would – There's just nothing that brings the carriers into joining this.
Well, except they don't want to be left out. In fact, 55 operators, carriers, have already signed up for it, including AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint, Rogers, and Orange.
Yep.
So the major
they
ones
all
have already
signed up for it, but they never deploy it. They've signed up for hundreds of these things over the years.
Dwight, you're getting in there, Dwight. So
yes. So one of these, you know, I mentioned this Galaxy S9. The review unit I got came from Samsung. So it's an AT&T phone, but it didn't come from AT&T. But even just coming from Samsung, it has already on it two messaging services. If this had come from AT&T, it would have their messaging service on it as well. And so there's no guarantee that you put one more messaging service on it that anybody's going to use it over any of these others. You know, I have a friend of mine who just switched from iPhone to the Samsung Galaxy S8, and he came to me and said, "So which one of these messaging things is the one that talks to other people?" And I said, "You know, they have their features where they will do things if they talk to the same messenger, but they'll both do SMS. And so there's no guarantee that if you put yet another Android chat thing on here, that people who are already using what they have are going to use it. And so, you know, even if it's as wonderful as Mike hopes it is, there's no guarantee that users will actually pick it up and use it.
But one of those apps that you mentioned is no doubt Google's own app, which is actually very popular, has 100 million users. And many of those users love it. It's probably their best messaging platform. And that one will get RCS. The carrier one will also probably get RCS. So of the four apps you mentioned, at least two of them are almost certainly have RCS built in. So, you know, I think what Google is trying to do, and I think that they might succeed, it looks like so far they might succeed, is you need to get a certain amount of momentum behind something. And once you have sufficient momentum behind something like this, then people will have to join because their users, their customers will be left out of this ability to communicate with each other.
But this was the original problem when telcos started to try and shift from SMS to different services that they could actually monetize, in that, you know, we had the whole MMS, the multimedia messaging services, which just died on its ass because nobody was prepared to use it.
Right.
There was a whole bunch of conflicting standards. Isn't this the same kind of thing? I mean, Google wants to create this unified app, but just doesn't seem to be able to get people to use it.
Well, again, if they can get the carriers to use it and get a significant number of app developers to use it, and they themselves in their own apps will use it, you're seeing, you're getting pretty close. I think as journalists, though, we should be cheerleading this thing, because anything that gets people off Facebook Messenger is a good thing.
Yeah, and I agree.
Yeah,
I
I'm
agree
with you on that.
Very strongly.
I loathe Messenger, but yes, I mean, it. Sorry, Greg.
I was going to say, the point of this is to give you a rich text messaging service that's independent of the vendor that's providing it. So in theory, RCS should provide us with an iMessage, Apple's iMessage, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, Snapchat type experience, but using the telco network. And that means that any phone could talk to any phone, regardless of operating system, regardless of app. It becomes ineffectively what TCP/IP is to the internet, this messaging, RCS messaging service. However, there's the challenge that, and I love Mike's inspiration and his belief that if we talk about it enough, I can't see where the money is. Where's the money for the telcos to spend to deploy this technology, to upgrade their infrastructure, to support this messaging across their backbones, which is, you know, not an insignificant cost. You're talking hundreds of millions for those sorts of organizations to do. Where's the motivations for them to do this? And I'm not sure I see that.
Is any kind of infrastructure upgrade required? Is it not just data?
No, it needs to be in the network. So where your 3G, 4G comes in, they've got to put appliances in there that receive the RCS and then forward. In the same way that there are SMS messaging platforms inside the telco's network handling the SMS. It's not IP. Today in 3G, 4G, it comes in as 3GPPP formatted packets and then gets translated through a bunch of appliances, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So is this why it's not encrypted? Why is there no encryption with it?
Well, there was no – in the days when SMS was invented, it was actually meant to be inside the network. It was meant to be an administrative back channel. Yeah, and the idea was that the SMS was, you know, send a query to the phone. Are you out there? Yes, no. You could do some diagnostics on the handset. And that's what the original idea was before. It was very loosely based on the ISDN was always two B channels and a D. So when they built the SMS standard, they decided to build a D signaling channel, but just left it open. And then they realized they could use it for messaging. So back in, you know, the late 1990s, there was no encryption, A, because we couldn't. The CPU.
But why isn't this encrypted? Why isn't this? Why isn't RCS?
There's
encrypted?
The killer point. Why?
That's
how is
what
it
I want to know.
Possibly put a messaging
because
app
it's that inside the network. It doesn't need to be encrypted if it's inside the network in theory, because the network itself is safe from external influences.
Yeah,
that's
SS7
a lie, by the
kind
way.
Of,
that is
but not system. From spying. But not from spying, and not from reading my messages.
And that's key,
you know,
here.
That's
I think.
What.
Governments don't want to see encrypted messaging. They want to be able to intercept. And unencrypted messaging running across private networks is perfect for telcos, because they can then exploit your messages, get in there and sell that data off to other people. Verizon is already making a $50 billion industry out of selling data about you to ad brokers today. So if they can get their hands on your messaging data and start selling that off to the ad brokers, or, you know, and you can package it up in, say, call it, you know, law enforcement, we give you legal intercept and all that sort of stuff. But I think the real underlying thing here behind RCS is that Verizon and AT&T want to see your SMS messages so they can sell that data just like Facebook does.
I think the best model for how it should work is Apple's model, which is basically you have one thing that is end-to-end encrypted, very secure for people who are also using the app on the other end. And then you have the other thing, which is not secure, it's not encrypted, but it's very universal. And so we're talking about replacing the second one without getting rid of the first one. I think that, you know, all of us should be using encrypted apps or signals, a whole bunch of them that are very good. And we should be using those when we have sensitive communication and so on. If we're sending stickers around with our friends and stuff like that, it doesn't have to be that secure, theoretically. And so we're talking about whether SMS continues another decade of life or gets replaced by something a little better. Like Greg said, it's nowhere near as good as the better messaging apps that exist today. Yep. But but it has the potential quality of being the universal also ran that you use instead of the very proprietary, specific encrypted messaging service that you want to use.
Well, I think, Dwight,
I just thought of why it's not encrypted, and I've just realized it's because who owns the keys?
Yeah.
For a message to be encrypted, there has to be an agreed private public key.
Saying that another way is that in order for it to be universal, it can't be encrypted.
Exactly. It just struck me while I was thinking about that, because otherwise you've got to have a root certificate authority and you've got to cross-sign it, and every telco would actually be answerable to a root, and getting all those telcos to agree to trust a given certificate authority. I mean, imagine getting the Chinese carriers to agree to a US-based certificate authority that's encrypting all the RCS messages. I don't think – so unencrypted. So it'll be up to the apps, the RCS apps on the end, to then encrypt and use that signaling, I would think.
You're looking slightly cynical about this, Dwight. What's your take on it?
He just looks cynical all the time.
Meow.
I was just sitting here thinking, you know what's going to happen tomorrow? I'm going to get a press release in my inbox saying, solving the universal messaging encryption problem, blockchain. I know that's
God, no. Blockchain with everything.
Right.
I had to drop the B word.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's
fun. I apologize but profusely.
I mean, I can't help feeling the, as you pointed out, I mean, we're going to be coming to this later in the show, but Facebook Messenger seems to be the most egregious part of this, where it is taking messaging and monetizing it and not giving it proper security.
Yeah.
And I've got a nasty feeling. Well, I'm hearing rumors that WhatsApp has really balked its signal implementation and is running into similar situations.
It's also Facebook. And so all roads lead to Facebook, and that has to change because Facebook is not to be trusted, in my opinion. And they
you
just
weren't
have,
impressed by his Android appearance in the Congress.
I was impressed by his Android-like appearance. Yes, that was the only part that I was impressed by. That was amazing. Yes.
Lieutenant Colonel, we've rustled your data.
Exactly.
Yes. the data meme was awesome from that.
It was just painful to watch. And I mean, I feel bad because some of our reporters actually had to sit through the entire congressional hearing. But Facebook stock price rocketed afterwards. He basically earned $4 billion from spending 2 days explaining how technology works to old people in the particular way that he did it. But, I mean, is Facebook Messenger the enemy, Mike?
Yes. They very much are. Facebook and Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp less so. As you know, as you all know, as people who travel outside the U.S., WhatsApp is the platform for messaging. Whenever I travel in Europe or elsewhere in North Africa or anywhere I go, they're like, "Well, what's your WhatsApp?" And initially, when it first came out and everybody started doing that, I was like, "What is WhatsApp? I don't even know what that is." Eventually, Facebook bought it. Now it's a Facebook thing, and now they're starting to Facebookize it, which means they're starting to use it to sort of exploit users for various reasons in this kind of bizarre way, steal their privacy, et cetera. And it's just a real problem because the reason everybody's on Facebook, the reason Facebook has dominance is that at the point when social networking went mainstream, Facebook was the mainstream social network.
Yeah.
And so they just won the lottery there. And now they have a monopoly on everybody. They have a monopoly on the fact that everybody's there. So everybody's on Facebook because everybody's on Facebook. And this is a terrible reason. And we risk continuing the slide to where Facebook is the de facto standard for all social and messaging communication. Where everything else is an also-ran. And that would be a disastrous world.
Scott Galloway is a professor at and he's been calling for them to break up all of big tech, actually, and he's making a fairly compelling case. Now, he's got a great YouTube channel where he explains it, and he's published a book recently. He's a professor at NYU Stern, and what he's saying is that you're going to have to break them up somehow. So Facebook could be forced to take Instagram and WhatsApp and float them off as separate companies, and they need to start breaking up Apple and Google. And his point would be is that these companies are so large that there's no longer any way for a capitalist market to function. And we've seen this before, and he lays out the entire case in his book and in his YouTube videos, that, you know, we saw Amazon recently announce that it was going to go into pharmaceuticals, was going to distribute pharmaceuticals, and that caused a $30 billion drop in pharmaceuticals market. That's not a capital market working that because Amazon's actually got a product and coming to market, and therefore you should be shifting your money to Amazon because it's going to use that capital more efficiently than the old than the previous companies. That's as soon as Amazon does anything, they're going to squash the competition. That's monopolist power there. And so I do think we're going to have to start seeing more moves against the companies to break them up into pieces so that they don't dominate the market like they do today.
But when you come to pharmaceuticals, you already have an oligopoly in the US. You have a very, very inflexible market, a couple of large companies dominating it. Wouldn't a company like Apple be coming in just to disrupt things? I mean, could they really get that kind of market leverage?
The point was that Amazon didn't even have a product or a business. They were just announcing that they might. Yeah.
And then they said they wouldn't. And then they recently said that they're not going to do that.
But you know, they're still thinking about it and working on it and stuff like that. The problem with regulatory breakups as opposed to just the ideal thing would be for people to wander away voluntarily from Facebook and have them become the new MySpace. And there's a chance that that could happen. I mean, right now the public esteem, the percentage of the public that says in polls that they don't trust Facebook after these hearings jumped from 20-something or 30-something to 70-something or 80-something. Mm. I mean, there's really been a turning point in the lack of trust of Facebook. And that's really the way to do it. And you see in a lot of the antitrust action in the U.S., it's so delayed that it's, you know, you look at the classic example of, the big threat of Internet Explorer dominating the world. I cover that heavily,
Microsoft got away with it in the U.S. In the EU, they got hammered. Yeah. But in the U.S., it was kind of like, well, promise not to do it.
But they didn't get away with much because the market took care of it.
The market took care of it, exactly. And that's the point I'm making is that...
That's not how other people see it. That's how the U.S. sees it, but that's not how everybody else sees it.
I mean, you don't think the rise of Chrome... kind of crush and the failures and the horrible reputation that Internet Explorer had is what dropped Internet Explorer to
Explorer had a de facto market monopoly. They had 95% of the browser traffic, right. And once they got that, they stopped development on it.
Yeah,
and pretty much dead. I know people on the who were then on the IE team, and they were basically said, "Look, just guys, coast for a year, find another department that you're interested in working in. We're not going to be doing anything here." Then Mozilla came along, then you're right, Chrome came along, and these were, you know, elements of how the market should work.
Yeah.
But at the same time, why did it take so long in Europe, in the US, whereas Europe were just like, that's anti-competitive, we need to levy a couple of billion dollars of fines on you?
Well, I think it has something to do with the fact that, I mean, if you recall, it wasn't the Justice Department alone, it was the state's attorney general going after this stuff. So it's like... We're like an EU with 51 countries in it, right? So,
hang on, the 51st. Are we talking the UK?
The 51st is Washington D.C. It's the federal government.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And so it's really problematic. Plus, it's a controversial idea. I mean, you know, Americans kind of like secretly love monopolies. You know, especially in a global marketplace where the U.S. monopoly is dominant globally. Mm. So it's kind of a benefit to American, the government or whatever. Powerful people in general would prefer that the U.S. the U.S. social network dominates the world and not the Russian one.
You're talking that you're bordering on the edge of U.S. imperialism at this point. I think the point is that Microsoft did basically create its own demise in the end. In the Internet Explorer was reasonably dreadful, and as in a product was nowhere near as competent as its competitors. But that was also because at that time Microsoft didn't believe in the internet. It just felt it had to respond to Netscape to the
reasonably
point where
reasonably dreadful. Now there's a product marketing term.
I don't know that I agree with that.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
That Microsoft didn't believe in the internet. There's plenty of writings from the time.
Well, Gates, Bill
it
Gates
came later.
I mean, Gates I've still got a copy of his book where he dismissed it as CB radio, but that was admittedly 92, 93. But yeah, they then got to it late and then rushed in.
Yeah, by Windows 95, it was they knew what was going on.
Yeah, and they threw a lot of effort and resources. Their fundamental argument was the reason Internet Explorer is dominant is not because it's bundled with Windows. It's because it's the best browser. If another company came along with a better browser, then we would become the minority market share, and that's exactly what happened.
Can you honestly say that IE won its market share honestly on simple usability, or because it was the first thing that people didn't know squat about the internet? Oh, that's a browser. I'll click on that.
It's a gray area because on the one hand, one of the aspects of its convenience was the fact that it was bundled.
Yeah.
But Internet Explorer, if you recall back in, you know, like Dwight's saying, that the heyday of Microsoft Windows and Explorer was 1995. At that moment, the Explorer browser was essentially integrated. It wasn't just bundled. It was integrated. It was in the operating system, baked in all the way through, and it was really convenient to use, and it was a really good browser. And you remember, this is before Chrome. This is before a lot of the innovation in browsers. Safari is actually not a bad browser nowadays. And back in those days, it was horrible. You know, it was absolutely horrible. And so it was pretty good. I mean, it was a pretty good browser. Plus, the other thing that you recall is a lot of people didn't know how to download a browser. Like, they didn't even, you alluded to that a second ago.
It was the year of modems. In the year of modems, you know, getting a hold of Firefox was a substantial task. So, yes, it was. But that was often seen as a competitive, as anti-competitive, because there was no way for Firefox or Chrome or any of the other, there was quite a few other browser companies out there at the time, in particular Netscape, who was charging $90 to $100 to buy their browser. They were basically taken out of the market by that monopolistic behavior that Microsoft decided to say, we're just going to bundle it up for free and that'll kill off that competitor.
Well, that ultimately was
the debate.
We'll come back to this in a little sec because I'd like to see how this relates to Facebook, because they've had some pretty interesting news weeks as well. Not least this last one, but in the meantime, here's Leo with the word for the latest sponsor from Twit.
Thanks for letting me horn in here a little bit just to tell you about something I think is really cool, but I can't do it. SEC regulations prohibit me from doing an ad and for using Betterment, and that drives me nuts. Betterment is the largest independent online financial advisor. They are so awesome. They're designed to help you plan for retirement, build your wealth, achieve your financial goals. And I have to say, and, you know, many of you probably, you're like me, think you can do it yourself. I set it all up, you know, read all the books, made all the investments. Problem is, you're supposed to keep track of them, like pay attention at least every quarter, rebalance. Pay it, you know, kind of make sure you don't get over invested in one sector, all of that stuff. And I did the first few years, and then, you know, I forgot about it. Has this happened to you? And then a few years later, you go back and go, oh, wow, I probably should have changed those investments. Betterment's doing it for you. In fact, they do it better than you ever could, not checking it every quarter or every month or every week or even every day. They're checking it many, many times a day because computers. Constantly making sure that your investment is on the right track, it's rebalanced. They're doing something, and this is actually a good time to do it, tax loss harvesting. When you take a loss in the market, and because the market's been kind of volatile, people are doing that this last few months. Do you know how to do that yourself? No, but Betterment does it automatically, which means you reduce your tax liability and increase your investment returns. This is the way to save. It's a flat fee. No hidden costs. There is never a transaction fee. You know, that can kill you. if you're buying and selling mutual funds or stocks or any ETFs, any instrument, and those transaction fees really add up. You have to make a lot more return to make up for the trend. Not at Betterment. No transaction fees ever. You get everything for one low, transparent management fee, 25 basis points. That means for let's say you have $100,000 under investment, $250 a year to manage it. And as a fiduciary, this is really important. That means they represent you and your best interest. They don't make commission. They're not incentivized to recommend any funds. They don't have their own investment products to sell. They work on your behalf, so you're getting the best investment advice. This is just easily the best way to do it. Betterment offers personalized advice and a suite of tools to help you know whether you're on track to hit your investment goals and get the retirement you want. And when you need it, their tools and guidance can help you improve your investments. Or you just set it on automatic. Do remember, of course, always investing involves risk. But we've got a great deal for you. Our listeners get up to 1 year managed free, not even 25 basis points, not even 0.25%, free. For more information, visit betterment.com/twit. Betterment.com/twit. There is a better way. There is. This is it. Betterment.com/twit. We thank you for their support. Back to Ian.
Thanks, Leo. Okay, now we were talking a little bit earlier about Microsoft being the de facto monopoly, Facebook being the de facto monopoly in some areas. I don't know about you guys, but I'm heartily sick about reporting on Facebook stuff at the moment. But it's the company that keeps on giving the headlines. So
have you seen the story today in the Wall Street Journal online from Christopher Mims? I can't read it because it's behind the paywall. Is it the guy who works for a newspaper that's also behind the paywall? But it's essentially he looks at the data that Google collects and talks about if you think Facebook is bad, look at what Google collects and what it does with it. You know, when this broke and I did a story about how to download your data from all these different services, and when I downloaded Google's data, it came in at like 3.5 gig of data. I've been using Google a lot longer than I have Facebook, so that's not too much of a surprise, but it's just a huge amount of data. And I think people underestimate when they point the finger at Facebook, I think a lot of them underestimate just how much information and data that Google gets and monetizes in the same way that Facebook does.
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons for that. There are three things that people should be or might be freaked out about. One of them is the fact that Google knows is very likely to know your exact location at every moment of your life for the last 10 years or whatever. If you go into their, what do they call it? The Google
the dashboard.
Yeah.
Dashboard.
Yeah.
And you go in there, it's actually quite fascinating. You're like, oh yeah, I remember when we went to that little town.
Even
in
if
Spain.
You have location turned off, it's still triangulating.
They have lots of ways to, cause you're using Google Maps, you're using this, you're using that. And they basically collect all that in a single place. The second thing that kind of freaks people out if they didn't know this was happening is that Google records and retains every time you talk to Google Home. So you can go in and listen to your own voice talking to Google Home, and you're like, wow, everything I've ever said to Google Home is right there. Or also the voice search feature. They collect it all.
But Amazon will do the same thing, presumably. And Siri as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazon is a lot less transparent about it. They don't have something like
yes,
Google.
Oh, it's in their app. It's in their app. If you look in the Alexa app, you can go in and see what's said and see exactly what triggers Alexa, which sometimes is pretty weird. Alexa has popped off when I have no idea what it was, and you can go in there and hear what you said. So yeah, it's available too. I think Apple discards it. I think Apple uses it for improving Siri's voice recognition, and then they say they discard that data quickly.
The biggest egregious thing that Google does that people don't care that much about is that in Google Photos, anyone can identify you personally with the face recognition of your face. So Facebook does this as well, except Facebook is actually more transparent than Google in this regard. So in Facebook, there's a place where you can go in Facebook if you care about it, and you can see that it's happening. You can turn it off. You can do this, that, and the other thing. Whereas in Google Photos, that may be the case. I'm not certain. But in fact, so many people use Google Photos. And I go in, I actually use this. I'm guilty myself. I use this feature. I go into Google Photos. I see that the people who have been identified all rise to the top. Mm-hmm. And in my case, I probably have 40 people that are identified by name. And I go in and I'm like, oh, look, there's Leo. Leo is identified up here, but down here is a picture of Leo that it didn't correctly. I'm going to tell him that that's Leo. So you're always refining their ability to do face recognition. On the plus side, Google's very secure. They don't make that information available to other people, but they have it. And again, just to be clear about what the transgression is, they are getting other people to perfect the connection between your specific identity and your face without your knowledge or permission.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
But you see, now Facebook I agree, Facebook is massively losing on the PR stakes, even though Google, as you say, doesn't sell their stuff. They just collect it and use it for their own purposes. But they also came out with a bunch of new privacy standards. I mean, at the Reg, we did a deep dive through these and found them to be pretty much useless. I mean, the rest of the panel, what do you think? Have you actually tried this out and checked out your own status?
I've dug around in there, and, you know, it depends on what you're looking for. I found things that I wanted, you know, that I did want to know. And the same thing is true with the capabilities for Facebook. But I always got the impression there was something else there that I was missing.
Mm. So I'm deleting my Facebook account. I'm just waiting for May the 1st when the GDPR comes in, because I don't believe that if I deleted it now, that Facebook would actually delete my data. I don't believe they're trustworthy enough to be relied upon unless there's a force of a law behind them. I don't use Facebook for anything, so I'm not going to miss it. I don't understand why people would want to use it. So to some extent, the whole kerfuffle about Facebook kind of baffles me. I've never used Facebook for anything meaningful. But hey, there you go. I think the point here is that exploitation of data is happening in multiple points. You're talking about Facebook and Google. I'm thinking about Verizon, AT&T, BT, Telstra. Mm. Those types of organizations are capturing the same data and actually have just as much personally identifiable information. There was an article in The Guardian for Sunday. Sorry, it's Monday here now. And it was talking about how the company that owns an insurance company, you know, the ones that you have to submit all your personal details to get a quote, they're now giving the data to a Cambridge Analytica. And Cambridge Analytica is then using that data to then do political profiling. That is the concern. To some extent, I'm less concerned about Facebook and Google, although they're evil to some extent in terms of it's Facebook's exploitation of the data. It's not actually that Facebook – I think the problem with Facebook is that they let someone else take the data, and now we don't know who's got it. Cambridge Analytica has gone from saying it was 22 million to 57 million, and today it's now 87 million.
And they gave this data on a pinky swear, saying, no, we'll delete it when we're done and the rest of it.
Yes.
I mean, and they will tell you that they have changed that policy and stuff like that, but I personally don't believe in this. This is based on the information that we have. There's probably a lot behind the scenes we don't know, but my current belief is that Facebook and Google don't belong in the same category in terms of trustworthiness.
Yes,
I think Google is far more trustworthy. I think Google actually tries pretty hard to be honest and upfront about what's happening with your data, whereas Facebook
now,
seems like a weasel behind the dirty tricks and all the rest to get your data and do things with it that you don't want them to do.
So the flip side of that debate is there's no way for somebody to come up and compete with Google because they can't get the data that Google's got. So the reason that Google doesn't share the data that it has or your search history with other people is because that it locks in their dominant position. Whereas Facebook has made a serious boo-boo here. It's made two boo-boos. A, it's got children in charge. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is clearly not an adult who should have the responsibility of having children, much less having control of it. I mean, like Silicon Valley is a factory of failure. Does it actually produce anything except accidentally? Like, you know, the one in 1,000, there's a defect, and goodness me, that's a successful defect. But anyway, I digress. So I think the point here is that, first of all, we're seeing how incompetent people like Zuckerberg and the people who are in charge of these companies. Like, we saw Google go out and get grown-ups who are now in charge of the company, and they were, you know, this don't be evil thing sort of came around when, you know, what's his name, the weirdy guy that used to be the CEO of Google came in and sort of put good procedures and stuff like that around.
Eric Schmidt,
that's right. And sort of, you know, we put an adult in charge, somebody who's got a grown up and normal person, actually has a, you know, a, some sort of an emotional attachment to the world instead of living in some ivory bubble. And the second thing about Facebook is that they actually don't know what they're doing. They gave away their data to their competitors. They aren't secure. When you're inside Facebook, you've got access to anything. So the employees inside of Facebook actually have access to the entire system. So if I'm the Chinese government and I want to get access to all the data, I'd just go and put an operative inside of Facebook and start nicking all the data. I don't think all that data's gone. And we're starting to see that people are realizing this, that it's not safe to be associated with Facebook. And I think Facebook is going to lose its friends, if it had any, fairly quickly as people realize just how much of the impact is that Facebook's been leaking all of this capability and just how little control it's got over its own business. It just doesn't know what it wants to do. And that, I think, is the message that keeps coming out, is clearly Facebook doesn't know what it's doing. It doesn't know why it's doing it, and it doesn't know how it's doing it. And that's why it keeps stumbling from disaster to disaster to disaster.
So I don't necessarily disagree with you, Greg, but I would think of it, I think of all of what you said in a different way. So first of all, I think Silicon Valley, there is something there. There's a lot of blundering. There's a lot of failure, but there is a lot of success. You can't argue with the fact that, you know, Silicon Valley invented the semiconductor, for example, or the most valuable company in history, or the search engine that dominates the globe in terms of search engines, or the social network that dominates the globe, and so on. And it's problematic that they dominate the globe, but they certainly can't say that Facebook and Google and Apple and so on aren't successful. You can say Twitter is not successful, maybe. But
Twitter has yet to make a profit.
Okay, well, we should rip into Twitter at some point.
Yeah,
as well.
We should.
But back to the point about Facebook. I think the thing about Facebook is not that they're a bunch of frat boys who don't know what they're doing. I think that their culture is based on sort of Mark Zuckerberg's personal mindset, which is a mindset of amorality. My working theory is that Mark Zuckerberg personally doesn't understand ethics. I don't know why. I don't know what it is about it. But basically, they see all ethical issues as sort of an engineering problem. So they try everything. And when there's pushback, they're like, wow, that's surprising. I guess we shouldn't do that. There's sort of a complete absence of an ethical compass.
What you're saying is Zuckerberg is incompetent. He's not fit to hold office that he has.
I'll agree with that.
He doesn't have the sort of 360-degree sense or the emotional range or the societal awareness or the political I'm not too worried about the technology side because he doesn't do that either. He's got people handling all of that.
So let's be concrete about this. So as an example of one of the things that Facebook does, they're required by the GDPR to have a buy-in for the privacy thing. So they rolled this out. They started rolling this out in Europe. It's going to roll out globally, they say, although it's going to be a different version despite what they've said. But basically, when you'll now in Europe, I think, get a dialogue box that says, we'd like to use your data for advertising and also scan your face for face recognition. Would you like to accept and continue? And then you're like, or not. There is not a button.
No,
there's just
accept
and continue.
Yes, you can have my data, but no, I don't want my face.
But the point is there's it's not a like yes or no. It's like yes or here's a complicated thing. The complicated thing is the dialog box basically says manage data settings. So it's accept and continue to use Facebook or manage data settings. You go into the manage data settings and it's like, wait a minute, are you sure you don't want to just accept? You really? This is called dark pattern. Or dark patterns interface design, where the interface is designed to get users to do things that are not in the user's interest, but are in fact in the interest of the company.
And Facebook is a master of this.
They're a master of it. Absolutely.
Dwight, you've been covering this since Mark Zuckerberg was a glint in the milkman's eye. But I mean, in terms of sort of where you think they're doing, do you think the company's serious about privacy? Do you think they're just basically going through the motions?
I agree with the whole concept that Zuckerberg kind of charges in, sets something up, says, oh, there's a problem, and then backs away from it. I think when you saw him testifying before the House and the Senate committees, you know, he had a fairly good handle on what he knew about. But when you went into issues of business and you went into other areas that he basically wasn't versed in, it really showed. And there were comments from afterwards saying from people who had talked to employees inside Facebook saying that Zuckerberg doesn't care about the business end of it, that he's more interested in this connection and in this community. And that, I think, is what keeps people in Facebook. You know, I did a story when a lot of this first broke about why people weren't leaving Facebook or wanted to. And if you talk to like everyday users, they are angry about this, but you know, they still want to see the photos of their grandchildren, and they still want to make sure that they're included in the event invites for their high school reunion. And the thing is that Facebook has 2.2 billion users. It is used extensively in everybody's everyday life. And if you're not on Facebook, you are left out of a lot of things. And the penetration for the usage of it is such that people look at it and go, yeah, but I have to stay here because all my friends are here. And I don't
and
think
that's
anything
called a monopoly.
Well, that's a monopoly.
Or critical mass, depending on how you look at it. Because, I mean, it always used to be the way that, you know, we saw with Friendster, you saw it with MySpace, these, they would go up and up and up. The next big thing comes along, and then it dies away again. And it hasn't happened with Facebook. And you were talking, Mike, about where we could go from this. We've had Elo, which was supposed to be the non-ad version of Facebook. We've had a couple more pitches this week about another thing. Is there any way, and this is a question for the whole panel, but is there any way that you can break this Facebook monopoly and get a better social network in place?
I think it's possible because something other than social networking comes along. I mean, you know, some people hope that it would be messaging. That doesn't quite work the way it could, partly because Facebook owns two or three of the biggest messaging platforms.
Actually owns its possible competitors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right.
So it's a monopoly,
a Swiss Army knife. It does everything. And in order for people to want to wander away from it, you're going to have to meet all of those needs. And there's nothing out there right now that does that. The closest thing historically to what Facebook is was AOL. And AOL failed because of an issue with the pipe that it was running on. It was modem based. And so when people went to the internet, AOL lost it. But Facebook doesn't face that at the moment. And there's nothing on the horizon at the moment that looks like it could do what Facebook does in its entirety.
Okay, don't laugh at me, Dwight. But there is one thing, there is a social network that's actually bigger than Facebook and more universal, which is email. Now, email is kind of has a mixed reputation. There are people our age have been using email for decades and get a lot out of it, need it. It's just there. It's always in the background. And younger people will kind of snicker at email. It's like the old thing. However, email has a significantly higher number of users than Facebook. And there's a lot of potential innovation that it can happen on there. The thing that, you know, again, the monopoly on everybody that Facebook has, you go to Facebook because everybody's on Facebook. Well, even more people are on email. And so if we could somehow turn email into a social network, I think that could be part of the solution. I think that a lot of companies are actually working on that.
Okay.
I want to take the debate a slightly different way. We recently saw Uber and Travis Kalanick finally come to a grim end. And now that Travis Kalanick is out of the way, Uber actually shows all the signs of being a company on the mend, if you will, or making good now that it's got a grown-up in charge. Could we actually see that as a template? Could there actually be a movement to say, you know what, we actually need to have some proper CEOs, somebody in charge of Facebook who is actually a competent human being?
Zuckerberg has rigged the entire share system so that there's no possible way he can be got rid of.
As did Kalanick, but he still got displaced. So I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm saying if there was enough of a push, if the politicians started to cut up rough and the financial backers started to cut up rough and the users started to say, you know, we need to see some change, there is a chance here that we could see him turfed out.
It's interesting. We're going to be coming back to something to, you know, commercial and government pressures in a little while. in particular, as it relates to Kaspersky and also the Microsoft email privacy thing. But first, here's Leo with a quick word of our sponsors for this week's show.
Thank you, Ian. Our show today brought to you by Eero. I think everything on this show today I use. Yeah. Eero is all over my house. I got Eero all over my house. Eero all over Mom's house, too, because she was having trouble with her Wi-Fi. Eero is a better Wi-Fi. Eero solves the problem of modern Wi-Fi. You know, when we first started using Wi-Fi many, many moons ago, what did you have? You had a laptop, a desktop, maybe a phone and a tablet. You know, a few devices. Now, it's not at all unusual to see dozens of devices on your Wi-Fi network. Go look. I have 62. Yeah, because doorbells, lights, all that stuff. And it's just killing Wi-Fi. Not to mention the fact that your neighbor's got a new Wi-Fi booster that's knocking your signal out. Wi-Fi, which used to be great, I think it was great, it's just really gotten problematic. If you're suffering from stuttering and buffering when you watch your Netflix, if you can't download fast, if you're waiting for email to arrive, you need Eero. Eero was started not so long ago, early 2016. Since then, they've learned every system they install helps them get better. Hundreds of thousands of systems have made them smarter, faster, more reliable. In fact, their new second generation Eero, that's why my mom has, don't tell my mom, I gave her my original Eero, which actually is fine. It's really been a boon for her. So I could get the second generation Eero, which is so cool. It's got the base station and the beacons, which just plug in anywhere there's a wall socket. Beautiful design. The beacons act as a nightlight, too, which I put them in the halls. Three radios, two 5Gs and a 2.4. So that's tri-band. It's twice as fast as the first generation Eero, which means you can do more. You and everybody else in the house can do more simultaneously. The new Thread radio means Eero connects to low-power devices like locks, doorbells, and other sensors easily and simply. Expanding your coverage is easy. I started, as most people do, with three Eeros, a base station and two beacons. But we have a pretty big house, so we got two more. That's really helped out in the far reaches of the house. You just plug it in a wall, and it joins. You completely control it with your phone. Eero Plus means I've got filtering against malware. The kid can't get on adult sites. I can even pause the kid's internet when it's bedtime. I can even use my Echo to do that. I can say, Echo, pause Michael's internet. Oh, I love that. He can't unpause it either. He has to. It's the best router you've ever had. It's more than a router. It's a Wi-Fi system. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Eero, Eero.com. And at checkout, select overnight shipping, then enter TWIT, and that makes it free. U.S. and Canada, free overnight. You do want this as fast as possible. Eero, I'm not kidding. It will solve your Wi-Fi woes. Eero.com. Enter the code TWIT. We thank Eero for their support. We thank you for supporting them. And we thank Ian Thompson for hosting TWIT this week while I'm on vacation. Back to you, Ian.
Oh, thanks, Leo. Okay, now I'm sure plenty of you have seen, avid watchers of TWIT have seen some of these. But here's a few things that you may have missed from this week's broadcasts.
Previously on TWIT.
Mike Boas, who watches the show, hi Mike, Mad Dog Movies, made us this is the closest thing so far Stacey has to the Punish Leo button.
Yeah.
Is that satisfying?
Security Now.
In the U.S., this is our tax filing deadline date. And one of the headlines I got a kick out of, said that the IRS's e-filing system is, wait for it, overtaxed.
Because what I saw was that the IRS didn't know why it wasn't working.
They don't. Yeah. No.
So it may not be overtaxed. So it may be something else.
Under attack. Yeah. Yes.
All about Android.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
The Huawei P20 and P20 Pro.
You can actually turn the notch off. I don't have a problem with notches, especially when they're implemented like this. Yeah. You don't see the notch anymore, but the notch is still physically being used by putting the battery icon and the reception icons in it.
The new screensavers.
Yep. You got to play around with the Nintendo Labo kits.
We're looking at a lot of cardboard, one rubber band, and a few stickers.
Is it time for you to go put that suit on? It's like a backpack. Oh, so you just stand up like Transformers?
No way! That was so cool!
TWIT, the happiest place on Earth.
Well, I'm glad Steve Gibson mentioned the IRS there, because as it is tax week in the US and everyone has been frantically scrambling to get their pound of flesh out of the government and vice versa, of course. And of course, the IRS website went completely tits up at the important time. They've had to extend the deadline. And in reports onto this, they've been shown that they've got, I think it was like 50 or 60% of their servers now obsolete or obsolescent. They have one mainframe going all the way back to 1964. America is supposed to be, you know, the cutting edge when it comes to computer technology. What exactly went wrong? Dwight, Mike, you're the locals here. What's your view on it?
Well, it was, you know, the U.S. is supposed to be cutting edge. The government never has been. And the government is frequently behind with every new administration, except for the current one. They've said what we're going to do is we're going to spend some money and bring in the expertise to fix things. And then that just never seems to actually happen. And the IRS also has had a bunch of budget cuts itself. So there aren't as many personnel there, and probably a little fewer IT personnel as well. So it's, you know, it may or may not be a victim of shrinking resources.
Well, actually, it's kind of saved us. The fact that the U.S., the government is behind the times means that we're still voting with like savages, with like pieces of paper in a cardboard box or something like that. And that's harder to hack than the alternative, which is a nationwide system.
Well, some of us are. Some of us are.
Yeah. I was gonna say,
there's a lot of problems with voting machines all around the country, and you know, where there is no paper ballot, and as we've seen at a couple of DEF CONs, those
existing machines are case in point.
Yeah, hacking village.
They haven't even finished the opening presentation, and some guy had managed to hack into one of these systems.
Yeah,
and I'm totally with you on this, Mike. Paper voting is incredibly difficult to hack, because you've got to get a large number of people signing on boxes, stuffing ballot papers.
Of course, in Russia, it didn't work, because they have a similar thing where they have paper ballots and stuff, and they actually put cameras at all the ballot boxes. And we all sat there and watched people stuffing the ballot box and committing all kinds of crimes, and then nothing happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the point that I think the thing to realize here is that, as far as I'm aware, the only country that has fairly substantial use of voting machines is the U.S., and they're the only people with this problem, as far as I know.
Yeah, I mean, Estonia's got some issues, but they had some issues with their security cards as it stood. But after the 2000 election, then the government threw money and said, buy electronic voting things. These things are pathetically insecure. I mean, how comfortable are you having the Republic in the hands of, you know, well not Diebold, but whoever the company has renamed itself for now?
Well, the dominant company itself is you know, sort of like compromised in a lot of ways. I it's been a while since I've read about the nature of it, but basically there's a resistance to building in real security for a variety of reasons. I don't want to talk too much about it, because I don't know that much about it, but it is a real problem, and I think we should go back to the way that used to vote in ancient Sparta, which is that all of the Spartiates would gather in one place, and then they would throw out a name, and then they'd bang on their shields, and the loudest noise, that was a winner. And so I think we should go back to that.
Well,
I think that'd be great.
Can't hack that.
They did have slavery in Sparta as well, but quite a lot of slaughter. But yes, I mean, Greg, in the UK, are they going for this sort of thing in a big way, or has Theresa May actually shown some elements of brain cells to rub together?
No, there's no signs of her having brain cells to rub together, but there's no signs of voting machines being adopted here, nor in Australia, which is the other place that I watch the politics for. And I think
voting is compulsory
sort of,
in Australia, right?
Voting is compulsory in Australia, yep.
It's a good system.
96-97% participation rate in the voting in Australia. Nobody gets to say, I didn't vote for that president or that person in charge, because everybody did. I think the interesting thing is that most countries have not implemented voting machines for the simple reason that you couldn't audit the results. So the part of the constitution of countries like in UK and Australia was that you must have an audit trail. There must be able to be a counted vote. And there has never been a push into voting machines, because it was always felt that the audit trails or the integrity of those was not actually up to snuff. And we've seen these voting machines. It turns out they're using like Microsoft Access databases from like in the 2000 era.
And you can Windows CE, for goodness sake, and that's called Win for a good reason.
Some of them are NG4, and you can use well-known vulnerabilities to compromise them on the LAN port, which is exposed on the back. and you can just hook your computer up and you can crack it in less than 3 minutes using any sort of off-the-shelf tool that you need.
On the other hand, there's an advantage to insecure voting machines, which is that the hackers will probably pick a better president.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on, you've seen 4chan? That's weaponized autism, for goodness sake. You know, we'd have, I don't know,
it depends.
PewDiePie
depends on whether it's the Chinese or the Russian hackers that are doing the hacking.
Well, this is it. How are things down in Texas, Dwight?
In Texas,
I just feel that the paper trails is still the way to go for the time being. And
definitely.
That I understand. That cost is a big issue. Voting machines are substantially cheaper than paper, and you know, having to move the paper around and organizing everything. I understand that. And American government is very big on not spending money because people in America don't like to pay taxes. So there's not a lot of money to spend on like building up infrastructure and doing things in ways that other people might choose to be. But it probably is time for them to just roll it back and start using paper, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, how do they do it in Texas, Dwight?
So there are different counties handle the elections in Texas. That's true in a lot of the states around the country. And so the counties actually buy the voting machines. One of the problems is that a couple of decades ago, there was a or maybe about 10 years ago, there was Congress approved a bunch of money to help counties modernize their election systems. And they bought voting machines all over the country, including here in Texas and in Harris County, where Houston is. And what has happened is those machines have aged, but it's very expensive to replace them. It costs tens of millions of dollars in a county the size of Harris, where you have about 8 million people living. And so if you try to do that, it's, you know, we're essentially they're stuck with these older voting machines. There's a company based in Austin called Hart InterCivic that is one of the biggest suppliers of voting machines in the country. They also make the paper stuff as well. And they have been going county to county and trying to sell their wares with their newest version, which is an electronic voting machine that also has a paper ballot attached to it. And that is seen as kind of the compromise that a lot of people want to see, where you have some way to back up what the voter actually intended to do.
Yeah, you know, it's a question of everyone keeping their pieces of paper at the end of the vote. But while we're on the topic of data security, we also had the U.S. Supreme Court actually chuck out a case which has been bubbling under for about the last 4 years, just in terms of background. This was the Microsoft Dublin case. What Microsoft was doing was fighting a subpoena from U.S. law enforcement who wanted data that was stored on their Dublin servers. They said, under Irish protection law, we can't give this to you. And also, you're going to need something more than a subpoena, something a judge might actually have to lay into. This had been bubbling under for 4 years. Microsoft has been saying, you know, we will fight for the rights of our cloud customers and also make sure our cloud business doesn't disappear entirely if we actually fall over on this. Then in the omnibus spending bill earlier in the month, then the Cloud Act got shoved in at page 2000, I think it was 2023, out of a 2,200-page act, which basically negated this whole thing, and now the Supreme Courts have turned it down, and Microsoft can cheerfully, with its hand on its heart, say, yep, have all the data. Was this a win for us or a loss?
Who knows, but I think it's definitely a win for whoever came up with the clarifying lawful overseas use of data or cloud.
Oh, but come on, Americans love this. The Patriot Act.
Absolutely.
The
most I hate that. I hate named, those acronyms.
You know, it just...
Yeah, I don't... I mean, on the one hand, you know, we all want better security. We all want data to be out of the hands of governments and others and just get, you know, we need privacy. And if that means the criminals get privacy too, that's just something that's going to have to happen. That's my own view. On the other hand, you don't want these shell games where you can just move data around theoretically in other countries. It's like, it's a ridiculous concept that data exists in a specific country, just on a server somewhere. All this gymnastics about data and where it resides is just a ridiculous idea. And you see countries like Russia and China demanding that data on their own. And there's only one reason for that, is so that they themselves can get access to that data, mm-hmm. so that they can repress human rights and democracy and things like that.
Yeah, yep. I mean, Greg, GDPR coming in on May 25th is going to throw a major spanner in the works on this one. I mean, how are these two sort of philosophies going to interact?
It's going to be interesting. I think I don't think GDPR is the right regulation to consider here. GDPR is saying if you're a company and you're holding data on users, you must only hold the minimum amount of data that's related to what you need to run the business. And you must throw it away when you have finished needing it. So you can't just gather up all the – you can't do a Cambridge Analytica, suck up all this data and keep it forever. You must delete it. And if you're found to be otherwise, the punishment is quite broad. So that's got nothing to do with this case as such. I think in what's we're going to see a really interesting thing here. U.S. sort of extending an imperial arm to say we can use any U.S. company as an extension of our law enforcement operation. What happens when – the UK government legislates to say we're going to use that to take stuff out of the US? Or if we start saying they reach into Ireland and demanding data that they want? And or what happens if the Irish government creates a law which says it's illegal for the US government to have that data?
Yeah, I mean
these are issues that are currently underway. The European government has shown its willingness to confront those types of issues head on and to have those and to go against what it is that America wants in this situation. And they, if they just made it outright illegal to take data out of Europe, then where does that leave us? Who's in charge?
Well, clearly the answer is for the U.S. to drag European leaders into a sort of a Colosseum type of situation and feed them to the lions. I think
two men enter, one man leaves.
It's an old-fashioned solution, but still.
Yeah.
A traditionalist.
Whose jurisdiction applies? So the U.S. government has decided that, you know, they can reach into – that a U.S. company operating in Ireland is actually part of the U.S. Jurisdiction, and therefore they can demand that that company cough up the data. But technically it's actually in on Irish soil, and that data belongs to Ireland. There's a definite clash of intention here that – that's going to be played out over time.
Isn't that going to lead, though, to countries siloing off information within their own borders? I mean, Dwight, what's your take on this? Because, I mean, it strikes me that, you know, that breaks one of the fundamental advantages of the internet and network communications.
Well, you can store data in one specific location. And I think that when you do that, you must be bound by the laws of that country. And I think that it has to be sovereign in that way. But the thing is that you don't have to store data in any one country. I mean, Google's data for its search engine is stored all over the place. When you end up with making a call to a website, you know, the data that it uses may not even come from your own country. And so I think that you need to keep that in mind as well, and the laws need to be written to take that into account. The problem is we don't have lawmakers in any country who understand that or who can write laws that are technologically savvy, I don't think.
It doesn't seem to be much evidence, certainly in Europe. Well, Europe's, I always struck me, there are some tech-savvy legislators in Europe. In the US, there are a few, but the bulk of them seem to be lawyers and operating on about 50 years out of date. Do you have any hope that the politicians can actually get this right, or is this going to be something that's just going to be worked out by hack and slash and a lot of people are going to get caught in the crossfire?
No. No hope at all.
Okay, well, with that note, we'll just hang ourselves.
I agree with Mike.
I think it is until you have people who run almost on a technological platform who tout that and have their bona fides, I think it's going to be pretty touch and go in terms of laws for the next 20 years.
And this stuff won't be determined by technical merit. It'll be determined by the flaws in human nature and also politics. So in all of these scenarios, the problem is that the case being made is, well, we can have law and order, or we can let the bad guys get away with hiding their dirty deeds on foreign servers. When it's framed like that, you're not going to get enough high-minded people, enough fair-minded people to say, you know what, that's not really what's happening here. We have to balance multiple. No. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen. Everybody wants to pander to law and order. Everybody wants to, human nature is such that we tend to focus on the problem of bad people getting away with stuff rather than the threats to good people when data is generally abused in that fashion. Mm-hmm. So I really don't think that the politics of our era will allow the kind of solution that will make everybody happy, at least everybody on this show right now, happy. We're not going to be happy.
Isn't it interesting that this whole show has been a discussion around politics, business,
privacy, society,
and we haven't really privacy. And we really haven't talked about a technology at all. And this seems like a major transition in technology, that we're no longer talking about the technology itself. We're really talking about how we as a fit into society. How do we fit into the political system? How do we make it so that technology can go beyond that first step that we've sort of been through over the last 20 years, and now it's seriously. So in a sense, I think what we're seeing is this emergence of tech as becoming mainstream, and this is the convulsions of teenage years in tech turning into an adult, and now we have to become part of society and part of politics and part of the business process that we never used to have in 10 years gone by. Because, you know, 5 years ago on this show, the only thing that we would have talked about is Apple iOS and the latest memory and the CPUs, and that's it. That's all we ever discussed.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's in part an evidence that the technology has matured to such an extent that we don't need to be constantly, you know, I mean, you remember what it was like in a way. We all remember what it was like in sort of the early 90s, where, you know, you bought the new processor because you had to buy the new processor to make the latest software run. Now, I mean, this computer is what, 5-6 years old? Okay, you're ahead of the game, but a lot of us are using, you know, computer hardware, which is, in terms of the 1990s, obsolescent or completely obsolete. And I think, Greg, you're right in that we're becoming, because technology is becoming that much more mainstream, that much more accepted, you know, our parents are using laptops, which we, you know, would have been, you know, gold mines back in the day. But you think it's going right. to be, I mean, Mike, you think it's going to be 20 years before we get this sorted out?
Well, I think that technology is not new anymore. In general, the idea that that anything that can run on a microprocessor, it's involved in every aspect of our world and is getting more complicated. I wrote a piece for Fast Company last year, which is one of the first in a long string that continues of articles about what happened to Silicon Valley, how did Silicon Valley go by, why does everybody hate Silicon Valley now? Well, these articles started back in fall of last year, and I wrote one of the first articles on that. And one of the points that I was making is that technology used to be so much fun. At first, we were enthusiasts, we were programmers, we were builders and makers, and we would tinker and we would mess with you. I remember that a lot of the, you know, in the 90s, it was all about, oh, you can add more RAM and you can do this, that, and the other thing, build your own PC. It was all fun. And then it was really fun in the 2000s because it was gadgets and smartphones and all this kind of stuff. It was just fun. We related to it on the level of fun. Well, we've gotten used to all that. Mm. And now we're dealing with AI taking our jobs. And we're dealing with all these complicated subjects that the public just does not understand but is directly affected by. And they feel victims of this. This privacy thing, there's building up the lion's share of what we talked about today probably and on many of these shows. This is a huge point at which the world of technology, the world of Silicon Valley, is directly affecting our lives, and there's nothing good about it. And to make matters worse, all of this harvesting of personal information is all in the service of contextual advertising. Is advertising really all that contextual? Are we getting?
If we were collecting all this personal data to do health research, to discover if cancer or to find out more about mental health issues or how we could, you know, all this data that we could have done with health science, all we've managed to do is turn it into advertising.
There is something very depressing about the fact that the finest minds in computer science aren't about solving the next processor gap, aren't about getting down to, you know, getting down and properly drilling down into how we build the next bits of kit. It's about how we can sell people stuff.
Well, actually, I mean, all of the above is happening.
I don't agree with that.
If I can make one quick follow-up point, I'm sorry to trample over you just because you're not here, Dwight. It's really hard to be on the other end of Skype because okay. It's like we have a millisecond faster. But just to follow up on that point, I think all of the good things are also happening, but we don't see it. Like there is research going on to cure cancer and to, you know, like 23andMe is using all this data and there's a lot of good stuff happening. We never see it. It's invisible behind the scenes. What is actually touching us? Well, data privacy, some of this other stuff, we're being tracked. You know, there's this general sense. So I think there's a lot of good, a lot of bad that's happening, but the bad parts right now happen to be affecting us. And I'll stop talking and let you talk, Dwight.
Well, yeah, Dwight. Mike, that was exactly what I was going to say, is that there is – I mean, people are using this data to look at ways to defeat cancer. People are using social media data to track epidemiology and to track diseases. I think it is a, you know, there's a lot of good stuff going on there. This is what's in the headlines right now. And I also think among tech writers, there is a little guilt going on. You know, I was, as I know you were, Mike, we were optimists. We were advocates. One of the proudest conversations I had was with a Compaq executive in the late 90s who told me that he thought that I was probably the person most responsible for teaching Houston how to get on the internet because I wrote the hell out of it. And that made me proud, but I kind of look back on that now and go, you know, what have we done?
Yeah, you really shouldn't have done that, Dwight. You should have kept Houston off the internet.
I know. Well, I was being paid to. So
Facebook and Google are the data scientists, and they're worth $100 billion, and we can't even funnel a handful of billions of. We talk about Apple coming up on $1 trillion out of smartphones, and we can't even put like $10 billion into health sciences.
Oh, well, come on, Greg. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg and his wife have claimed that you know, they've set up the Chung Zuckerberg Foundation to cure the world of all known diseases within the next 20 years.
And,
of course,
and
it's
Greg,
rubbish, but you know,
Greg, yeah. Greg, I would invite you to come to Houston and spend some time in the Texas Medical Center, which is one of the largest medical complexes in the world. There are billions being spent on medical technology. It's just, again, as Mike said, you don't see it.
I've toured some of those, and I've worked in the medical system over 30 years as a corporate IT person. And yes, there is money being spent, but it's still a fraction of what we're seeing. I mean, there's an article in here somewhere that Facebook is now working on its own artificial intelligence chips. We need those chips in health sciences. Why is it that they're not being funded for that sort of technology? Why is it that an ad tech company is getting to make these market-leading innovations instead of something useful?
Who's to say that Facebook won't sell them to medical researchers?
Well, they've done it with the Open Compute Project. They've actually managed to get some decent server designs out there, out on the large scale. But with something like that, where they're looking at the level of investment you're looking to AI chips, they're not really going to hand that over, surely.
Well, you probably might sell not. It if you sell it as a product. Mm. I mean, that's what they do, is they sell products.
They sell ads, according to Zuckerberg. But actually, that was actually, to me, the single most disturbing point of all that, where they were talking about fake news and they were talking about all this kind of stuff. And Zuckerberg said, they were saying, well, what are you going to do about this fake news? It's a real problem. What are you going to do about it? And he said, well, we're to the point where within 10 years, we'll have AI that can catch it and delete it instantly. Oh, and they're like, okay, that sounds great. And I was like, are you kidding? That does not sound great. This is all going to happen invisibly behind the scenes. We don't know what was deleted or why. They're just going to decide what's deleted and what isn't. Some algorithm is going to decide that, like, with no record or trace of what's happened. I mean, that's a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, coming back to what you were saying.
No transparency.
Exactly. But just on one final point, because we ended up the week on Friday with some quite unusual news and a bit of, you know, war of words going across the line, when Twitter, out of the blue, decided that they were no longer going to carry ads for Kaspersky. Now, we've seen the US government has already put, a moratorium on Kaspersky software being used in the government. European governments have said, we don't have a problem with it, we work with them all the time. What is behind all this? Was this just Twitter in its endless quest to carry on losing money and not make a profit, or is there something that we should be seriously concerned about this, about Kaspersky software and the way it works?
Well, a lot of this, again, is politics, and there may be more that we don't know behind the scenes of all this, but it's this association, it's the use by the Russian government and the Russian intelligence services of Twitter to forward the objectives of the Putin administration in Russia. That is generally disturbing. So on one end of the spectrum, it could be that Twitter wants to look like they're being tough on the Russians. And on the other end of the spectrum, there could be genuine problems with Kaspersky and what they're doing, and they want to bump them off the network. Either way, it's not going to make much of a dent. I mean, it's like, you know, really, how much does Kaspersky need Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems slightly hypocritical, you know, in that you don't see... I mean,
the CIA's investment arm, InQtel, has funded an awful lot of security companies like, you know, FireEye and a bunch of others. And you don't see other companies saying, well, they're funded by the US government, we're not going to use them. I mean, I'm getting a little bit sick of being told Kaspersky's a threat, Kaspersky's a threat. What's your evidence? Oh, you're just going to have to trust us on that one. And we're still looking for chemical weapons in Iraq. And I'm reaching the point where I'm not really leveled ready to take blind trust.
So the scuttlebutt around Kaspersky is there was a person. So here, let's sketch out a potential story that may or may not be true. There was an FBI or a CIA person who was taking data from classified secure data and
NSA
keeping
contractor.
It at home.
Yeah.
And as part of that process, that person had the machine at home, was running Kaspersky, and as part of the process of Kaspersky scanning for viruses, it found a document in there which had a virus in it or thought it had a virus, and the document was then uploaded to Kaspersky servers. And they think that somebody in Kaspersky, who was probably an operative for the KGB or one of the or the FSB, realized that this person was actually holding on to confidential or top secret documents, and then use Kaspersky to leak that data, either to run a full-blooded op to get in there and steal the computer and thus all the data in it. Now, this person, this employee, should not have had the data at home, and the fact that it leaked through Kaspersky may actually be an accident. So that is, Kaspersky as a company may not have been acting deliberately or intentionally as an arm of the Russian government, but maybe there was an operative just happened to be in the right place at the right time and saw what was happening. The net result is that Kaspersky ends up looking like an instrument of the Russian government. The Russian government has already took steps this week, of course, if you want to take the reverse political play, to make sure that Telegram can't operate. So they've made a decision. The courts over there have decided that Telegram is a danger to the country, and the Russian ISPs are now blocking all the IP addresses that Telegram uses, which basically took large swathes of AWS and Google's clouds offline so that certain services stopped working over there. So there's a lot of tit for tat. Don't forget that the Chinese government has been blocking out US services from working over there. Google documents, for example.
Apple has rolled over on VPNs in China as well.
Exactly. So it's not fair to say that the US is the one that's taking the hits here. I think there's an awful lot of, you know, geopolitical maneuverings going on here. And today, Kaspersky's getting it in the neck in the US. But there's hundreds of other movements going along. We saw the Cisco this week. There was a joint announcement from UK's GCHQ and the NSA in the US and the DOD in Australia, highlighting the fact that Cisco routers have known vulnerabilities and that there are actors, believed to be state actors, Russian and Chinese actors, who are actually implanting those routers to hold them as potential staging points for future compromises and sort of pleading with operators to get out there and patch these systems so that those implants can be removed from in the network. So this whole security issue, this is why I'm not at RSA, because this sort of stuff doesn't get talked about at RSA. And that's the real security issue, is that 300,000 routers out there are now open to a remote code exploit, single packet, hammer it, you've got yourself, you own the router. You can then use the router to configure a GRE tunnel and snuff in the traffic off. If you know what you're looking for, you can send the traffic off and then capture it and then do what you want with it. Or you can pop the router and wipe it, take it out. Like big swathes of the Iran ISPs went down when somebody went in there and popped all the routers and wiped them all out.
And so, also, I mean, as we saw with Slingshot, when you've got access to the router, who's the person that goes in and configures the router? That's the IT admin, and they are the golden ticket if you're trying to hack a network. Right. Get full admin access for your administrator, and then job done. I mean, Dwight, what's your take on this? I mean, would you trust Russian software on your computer, or is it? Do you think it's overblown?
I think I want to see more evidence. I'm also just as skeptical of the U.S. government's attempt to make sure people don't use ZTE and Huawei and other Chinese products. You know, you keep hearing from the feds that there are issues and you shouldn't trust it, but I have yet to see any technical discussion or any technical proof that there are indeed backdoors in any of these products. There may be. And certainly, you know, the Chinese government has that history, but I have not seen any technical proof of it unless I've missed it. Mike, have you seen anything on this?
No, not proof, not smoking gun proof. I do think that that governments and agencies tend to suspect that their rivals do the very things that they in fact do. Mm-hmm. And so you can sometimes tell what spy agencies are doing by what they're accusing others of doing. So I remember a few years ago, the NSA was caught intercepting laptops that had been ordered abroad. They were intercepting the packages, installing stuff inside of the laptops, repackaging them, shipping them off.
With Amazon's full support as well.
But this is the kind of thing that, that the U.S. government is accusing ZTE and Huawei of doing. Mm. And it may be because they are doing something like that. It may be because they might possibly be doing something like that, or maybe because the U.S. has done something like that and figures, well, they ought to be doing it if they're not. So we can't take any chances, and in any event, it's good to sort of swat down. They're more concerned about ZTE and Huawei's telecommunications equipment, not their phones. ZTE's troubles are something unrelated to that whole issue, which is the Iran, violating Iran sanctions and so on. But
AT&T and Verizon were pressured to stop by the U.S. government to not sell those phones. And, AT&T walked away from a deal they were just about to close.
Yeah, Huawei got quite heavily hammered on that one. And we also had the announcement today this week with the block on ZTE, which has actually hit some American companies quite hard. I mean, Qualcomm have got other markets, but one of the other companies' name, they saw their stock price go down by a third after the announcement came out.
It's really bad. CNN. I mean, I've heard some reports that ZTE is actually the number three smartphone vendor in the United States. They hit the very, very low end. They're an Android Go partner within the U.S. and so on. But it's still not clear, whether they'll be able to continue, get around the sanctions somehow, around Android. Google and ZTE are working together to figure that out. But even more, something that people aren't talking about enough is that they may not be able to update current phones. Mm. It's possible that they will be blocked from actually giving security updates to the millions of ZTE phones owned by Americans right now. So this is a real question that has to be resolved, and I hope that it's resolved in a way that
better. That's going to leave a swamp of infected phones out there, just spreading that stuff around everyone else.
Yep. Now, there's also some business issues here. If you figure that Huawei and ZTE are two of the most aggressive competitors in the technology space, and if they've now been frozen out of the U.S. market, which is fine, the government can and the people can make that decision, then that leaves those companies now aggressively competing in Europe. So if you're a U.S. multinational who's already losing ground in China, now all of a sudden your European market is going to start to wither away because the Chinese people are going to go, the Chinese firms are going to latch onto Europe. So, and the U.S. economy may suffer as the U.S. Companies say, well, we're the only last people standing. There's no competitors here. So we'll raise our prices and not worry about innovation and not worry about advancing the product cycle. And then over in Europe, we're buying the same technology for half the price and they're competing against the US companies. And, we get the best of all of those worlds. There's an argument to be made here that this actually has long-term impacts on US companies where if they by kicking out Huawei and ZTE, it actually leaves Europe gaining the benefit of those vendors and their technology and leaving the U.S. vendors in second place.
I would say the U.S., certainly comes to mobile phones, then, China does seem to be, really, obviously most mobile phones are made in China, but the Chinese brands, Huawei, ZTE, they seem to be coming on because they aren't going for the same market that Apple's going for, coming back to what we were talking about at the start of the show. They're going for the low cost, easy to use,
For both of these things I was talking about is 5G. So both Huawei and ZTE are doing 5G networks. Huawei's got routers and switches and wireless solutions and servers and storage arrays, as well as smartphones. So Huawei is a $50 billion a year, $50 billion turnover a year company. And it's not just smartphones. It's right across the board of technology. ZTE is one of the biggest telco suppliers in the world today. And that's why companies like Ciena took such a hit when they got penalized by the U.S. government.
It kind of makes you feel that it wouldn't be nice to go back to the old days when Nokia was handling all this stuff, because Nokia and Ericsson, because everyone trusts, the Swedes and the Finns, but no one trusts the Chinese and the US.
That's right.
So where do we go from here?
Yeah, that's right. It's very complicated in the sense, but, you know, if you say to, if you pull the competition out against the US companies, do the US companies maintain their pace of innovation, maintain their push and their momentum? Can they come to Europe? And then all of a sudden, when they get to Europe, they're competing in a completely different market. They've got to compete against the Chinese makers and the Chinese vendors and their products and their aggressive pricing. And then all of a sudden they may start to lose ground in Europe, and then the US companies start to pull back to just the US, and then you would go back to where we were in the 80s and the 90s, where US telecoms was, you know, arguably the least best technology in the world.
I think the biggest change that will happen with the rise of the Chinese smartphone vendors is the demise of Samsung as a smartphone vendor. Mm-hmm. I think Apple will be okay.
Think Samsung's going to concentrate on the chips? Because they've actually cracked the single-digit nanometer processing in a way that Intel still can't manage to do.
Chips and all kinds of other components as well. There's a lot of profit in that, and if they can maintain their lead in the components business and also keep their foot in the global smartphone. You know, if you go around the world, you go to the African continent, and it's all Samsung. Well, it used to be. And now, increasingly, that's being taken over by Chinese companies. But in terms of the market mind share in Africa, half of the billboards that you see in a lot of African countries are for smartphones, and 95% of those are Samsung. They spend a fortune to market Samsung phones globally. So I think Samsung is in for a world of hurt. I think Apple will be okay, and Google will probably be okay. You know, they're not dominant now, but I think they'll slowly rise in their position. So I think we're facing a world that will be U.S. and China. And I think the days where it was, the Swedes, the Finns, and the Canadians dominating the world phone market, with BlackBerry. I don't think we're returning to that.
No, I mean, BlackBerry is essentially a patent monetization company now. Nokia got killed by Microsoft in the worst possible way, and also because they dropped the ball on the market. Alcatel is going nowhere. I mean, it does seem like it's China or bust at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Nokia and Ericsson are still very strong in the 5G market and still hoping to make substantial revenues in that market. And they remain the strongest players in the 5G market today, although ZTE is very much the third wheel there. And Qualcomm also has a lot of patents and stuff like that around the 5G technology. So it's going to be interesting to think about this in terms of that dynamic as the technology rolls out around the world. Maybe you end up like back where we were in the 2000s, where, you know, all the US technology was built by Qualcomm, and then outside of it was all done by Nokia and Ericsson for 5G. And the question, and now, of course, China's arrived, and you've got ZTE handling the Asia Pacific and the Chinese regions. Maybe that's the way it's going to pan out, and it's going to go back to a sort of, you know, local technology for local solutions.
Well, this is it. I mean, and Dwight, you were born, you've been in the heart of Compaq and seen that blow up and then die down.
Oh yeah.
Do you think we're going to see the same sort of thing, occurring when it comes to the mobile sphere?
Well, you know, the comment about the local companies doing local solutions, that's kind of what the nationalist movement wants. You know, they want everybody kind of off in their own ring. And, you know, I'm not sure that you could put the genie back in the bottle. I think that they're going to try. The other thing is I'm curious as to just how much the blocking of these Chinese vendors in the United States is a function of the current administration. You know, you may have a change in administrations in 2020, and things may change. But it comes at a bad time, as we mentioned, because of the 5G rollout. These companies are very much involved in it. So I think initially, at least for the next 4 years, I think we're going to see everybody kind of off in their own silo.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be looking that way. Well, thank you very much for everyone for appearing. Mike, you're now the traveling tech reporter and that's gourmand. Right. What's the next stop for you?
That's right. So if you haven't heard about what we do, my wife and I, it's mostly her business, but we both participate. It's called the Gastronomad Experiences. So what we do is we go to an amazing food place, and we live together in a big, beautiful house for about a week, and we do amazing. We take cooking classes. We learn to make cheese. We learn to make and taste wine. We do all this kind of stuff. So the next ones are the Prosecco Experience in northern Italy, about an hour north of Venice, in May 21st. And then after that, the Provence Experience, which is June 26th, again for about a week. Now, here's what we're doing. These are These are fully booked, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we will make room for a couple, two people, if they are TWIT Army members. So it's we have a potential reserve spot in each of these, one couple for each, but only if you're a TWIT audience member. And because we love the TWIT Army, we absolutely do. And so I recommend that people go to gastronomad.net/experiences.
Okay.
Or go to gastronomad.net and just click on the experiences link and check it out. If you're gonna, if you want to have the foodie adventure of a lifetime, you definitely should join us. And again, this is for TWIT Army people, and we'd love to have
if you're going to be doing the food experience, then yeah, you know, Provence is the way to go.
And it's full of secrets, but I will just promise that it'll be the greatest experience of your life.
Excellent.
You should come, in fact.
Ah, well, I've just come back from Europe, but next time I'm over, I definitely shall. And Greg,
are all the panelists eligible?
Yeah, absolutely. As long as you listen to Twitch shows.
Oh, but I mean, come on, Dwight, could you honestly give up the joys of barbecue and huge steaks? And
you have a point.
Yeah, it's well.
No, actually, I love food. I would love to go to the Prosecco one. Just sounds awesome. I love food from that region, so yeah. And particularly the wine. So I would love to do that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Dwight Silverman from Houston Chronicle, runner of the Tech Burger site, and as you said, we've been in the tech sphere for since 1990, which I guess puts you in it longer than some of our listeners. But I got the same sort of feeling when I got my RSA badge and found out I was a 20-year veteran this year. So it's just, it catches up on us all. And finally,
well,
Greg,
you know what's,
sorry.
I made the comment earlier about kind of feeling guilty, but you know, I was away from doing this for a while and I'm back covering tech, and it remains a joy. And by the way, I want to say I've done a lot of This Week in Tech episodes. This easily has been one of the best and the most interesting and the most robust. You've done a great job, Ian.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I think it's down to the panelists more than those. But yes, it's. But yes, and Greg, also, you've had a Friday afternoon in the pub enjoying Britain's unseasonably glorious weather.
Can you see my tan?
Oh yeah, but come on! I mean, you know, we're naturally British. So our natural color is pale blue, and it takes a week in the sun just to get white.
Greg, your skin is rose gold, and your hair is space gray. You look like an Apple user.
I am an Apple user. Ian, you did a great job today. It's been great. Thanks so much for inviting me. And if people would like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as @etherealmind. And if you're an IT infrastructure nerd like me, I have a you can head on over to packetpushers.net, which is our podcast channel where we punch out really nerdy, really deep content on enterprise IT and cloud infrastructure. We'd love to see you over there.
And well worth a listen too. I know I certainly sort of it's certainly on my download list. But there it is. Another Twitter's in the bag, another week in technology gone by, and some good robust discussion and not a little laughter on the show. And we'll hope you join us for next week, where it'll be Becky Woolley who'll be hosting the show until Leo gets back. But in the meantime, have an excellent week.